the sun, the life force of our solar system. Its photons of energy can remain trapped in the sun's sphere for 100,000 years. And when finally they are released, it will take the photons 8 minutes to travel from the surface of the sun to the surface of a leaf on planet Earth. A leaf is a marvel of evolution. It transforms the photons into food for planet Earth, creating a foundation for all life. And it begins with a tree. It's time to look again at that tree outside your door. And to the forest beyond.
My name is Diana Beresford Kroger. As a classical botanist and medical biochemist, I have a lifetime's passion for trees. We've just started to understand that we've missed the big picture where the forests are concerned. They have a bigger genome than we have. They have more complex chemistry. And now the forests are coming down, but we have missed the essentials of what a tree is all about.
When you come into the forest like this, the first thing that hits you is the smell of the earth, the smell of the humus in the earth, the smell of the decaying twigs, the smell, that wonderful smell that rises up to you and meets you.
We all feel better when we're around trees and when we walk in a forest. But why? For over 1,000 years, the Japanese have been coming to their forests to do what they call forest bathing. From school children to businessmen, they all come here to forest bathe.
Forest bathing is really about immersing yourself in the bath of medicinal aerosols that make up the forest atmosphere. And the benefits are many.
I'm in on the top, no, halfway up Mount Kurama. What I'm doing today in the woods is a picnic, and it's a molecular picnic. And I'm joining, it seems to me to be, the rest of the Japanese population today on this wonderful day in fall, forest bathing.
If you feel refreshed and invigorated after a walk in the forest, there is a chemical explanation.
A tree is not just a tree. Some of the most complex chemistry that is found on the planet is produced in the furnace of a tree. One of the most important trees at the Shinto shrine is the sacred Sugi tree.
And for those who speak Latin, it's Cryptomeria japonica, the sacred tree of the Shinto shrines.
The Sugi and many of these trees around me are indeed very powerful in the work they do with this molecular screening of chemical aerosols into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
These aerosols directly benefit your immune system. Trees create many of the chemicals used in the manufacture of approximately 60% of our medicines. From aspirin and caffeine to paclitaxel in the treatment of breast cancers. And trees continue to be rich banks of biochemical possibilities.
These previously unknown compounds are the source of many new exciting medicines.
And that's part of forest bathing.
Everyone benefits.
Trees are the secret to our existence because they rule this planet on every physical plane. The land, the sea, and the air. So much of our world is invisible to us, such as all of the chemicals that are the building blocks of a healthy, balanced, and breathing world.
This spruce tree, it's an Engelmann spruce. It's an ancient, ancient tree. And it has a fiery canopy of all kinds of chemicals in it. This tree produces a whole treasury of aerosols. The aerosols are alpha pinene and beta pinene. Then in the air there is boronyl acetate. In the air there is a form of camphor compound. Liberated with that is a limonene compound which aerates itself, firing up into the atmosphere like the parasols of a dandelion.
It is an applicator chemical, an aerosol.
So all of those chemicals, those pinenes, are now in my lungs.
The limonene produced by these trees is used in chemotherapy.
Limonene is anti-cancer compound. The pinenes are antibiotic compounds. And what they are doing to me now is they're giving me a slightly narcotic reaction. They have an anesthetic reaction on my brain and in my myelin sheaths, in all the message areas of my body, just messages, just like a computer system. And what that is telling me is to relax.
As my immune system is being boosted. Cities everywhere need trees. To bring in birds, to clean the air of airborne pollution, and to soften the concrete experience.
One man who has given this much thought and is getting his hands in the dirt is Professor Akira Miriwaki. He has spent 50 years traveling the globe, planting and restoring native species forest systems. He's turned his attention to Tokyo, the city he calls home. Professor Miyawaki searches for every nook and cranny in Tokyo to fill with native trees, the big, small, and tiny, creating what he calls the world's smallest forests.
This is a perfect example of a city forest.
Yes, it's very important.
City forest.
Yeah.
And the smallest forest in Tokyo.
Japan has a lot of forests, but most of them are secondary or artificial forests. In the countryside around her farm in Ontario, Canada, Diana Beresford Kroger noticed many tree species disappearing. She made the decision to preserve and protect them. For over 40 years now, she has devoted her life to collecting, trialing, breeding, and studying rare North American tree species to survive climate change. Building a living library to ensure biodiversity, food, and medicines. As she did, she realized this has to happen all over the globe, wherever the native forests are falling before human need and greed.
This led me to the outlandish notion that we must replant the global forest, our cheapest and best defense against climate change.
E.O. Wilson, Harvard entomologist and considered the father of modern environmentalism, calls Diana's ideas a rare, if not entirely new approach to natural history. That revolutionary approach led to her series of groundbreaking books, Arboretum America, Philosophy of the Forest, Arboretum Borealis, A Lifeline of the Planet.
And The Little Global Forest, that's a prayer book, you know, a prayer book of the forest.
I planted this black walnut as a seedling here on my farm almost 30 years ago now.
It is a tree that really grows in all of eastern Canada, down into the States, way down actually into the Mississippi. It's really an extraordinary state of affairs where everything around this tree benefits from it. It is really a medicinal tree and it produces a fruit. The fruit is a nut and the nut is here. The nut is like a globe, really, isn't it? The protein of these nut meats is as good as any beef on the market. Then these nuts have got minerals, all kinds of unusual minerals. But they have got something else, three items that are very, very scarce in our food nowadays. The flesh of this nut has oleic, linoleic, and linolenic acid in them. These are the three essential fatty acids for the development and repair of the brain. The functioning of transportation all through the body for neural messages, because these acids, these fatty acids, protect the myelin sheath of the human body and of the animals. And what you should have is maybe two or three or four of them a day. And also, once upon a time, these were part of the great savanna of North America.
This North American sister of the Japanese sugi, the American redwood, is one of the world's most loved trees. And for good reason. Its sheer size makes it so memorable and inspiring. It's the largest carbon-bearing living organism on Earth.
For an Irish woman, this place is haunted. It's haunted by silence and a certain quality of mercy. The trees are enormous. They're called sequoias. Evergreen sequoias, Sequoia sempervirens, which is the redwood. The redwood is the tallest tree, the tallest conifer on the planet. It will go up to maybe 40 stories. It will soar right up into the sky. Chief Sequoia called them the kings of the forest, and they are indeed the kings of the conifer forest. But this is a very, very unusual place in all of the planet.
while I was working with redwoods as a research species, I have to tell you, it's a pretty easy tree to fall in love with. We haven't really started to figure out yet what's going on in trees, and particularly what's going on underground. I mean, we stand here and look at these things, and above ground is awesome. We still don't know how water gets to the top.
A few weeks ago, I was sitting at my kitchen table, and I was thinking about the volume of a 2,000-year-old redwood. I decided that I would, in my mind, create a scale. And I would put a 2,000-year-old redwood on one side of the scale. And what would balance out that scale? And it would be a whole town. And the town would be, I figured out the volume of about 13,000 people. And that boggled my mind. And then I got the idea of the volume of these trees. It's just immense.
If you look at the rings on this tree are very small. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much diameter and there's so much height that the year's growth is being put on a whole lot of very small places. Mm-hmm. But when you add it up, a big tree like this is growing faster now than it has every time in its life. They don't slow down.
These redwoods that remain with us are really the runts. The straightest, biggest, oldest trees are always the first to be logged. By the 1870s, most of the remarkably big redwoods were already taken for lumber. These were the mother trees, 2,000 to 4,000-year-old trees. We now know that these really big trees, the mother trees, in any forest system, essentially nurse all of the forest around them. By way of carbon and nutrient transfers through the underground network of root and soil. And when these dominant trees are removed from a forest, the integrity, health, and the quality of a forest is significantly diminished.
Before the last ice age, the various redwood species grew across the entire northern landscape of planet Earth. After the last ice age, we were down to some 2 million acres of redwoods, mostly in California. And now, with the present and ongoing chainsaw cycle, we are down to about 133,000 acres.
The redwood forests of North America stretch from the Choctaw River up in Oregon down to the Monterey Peninsula and a little bit closer maybe to San Francisco. Think of these redwoods as a whole series of tall green curtains stretching up and down the coast. A green wall on the lower area and a green wall on the mountainous area. That green wall is connected to the atmosphere and in turn is connected to the great ocean of the Pacific in a rather extraordinary way. In the morning here in California, the mist rises in from the sea, and it is actually drawn in from the sea by the heat of the land. But these green curtains trap that mist. These trees are acting as condenser units, or green machines, for the collection and preservation of water. They're pulling the moisture up from the aquifer, but they're replenishing the aquifer again and again by condensation of fresh potable water from the ocean mist. In the past, the redwoods provided this service here for the West Coast.
California is very dry, and it is getting drier. And as these trees come down, it's getting drier and drier again.
These redwood forests need to come back.
A strange desert was created in Japan more than a century ago. It happened on the Irimo Peninsula on the northern island of Hokkaido. Japanese settlers clear-cut the native forests to create farmland. But with the trees gone, the rich humus layer created by the forest was gradually blown away by the constant high winds. The land became a barren desert. That desert extended itself into the sea. Along thousands of kilometers of coastline, the marine ecosystem collapsed entirely. It was a mystery to everyone.
Professor Katsuhiko Matsunaga solved this mystery. It all begins with a molecule of iron. Iron is the foundation of the marine food chain.
You found something that was so simple and yet so valid for everything all over the world.
Now we know the oceans feel the effect of a forest clear-cut hundreds of miles away. Maybe this is why the Japanese have come to say, seek a fish by climbing a tree.
Along the Wild Pacific Trail, I came upon this great western red cedar. It measures over 54 feet in circumference and is over 1,000 years old. But as with all trees, so much more is going on here. The DNA in each cell of all trees codes the tree to produce protein.
And it produces all of the manufacturing needed for its health, just like you and me.
In this ancient red cedar and all other trees, they are not far off you and me in their capacity to live, but they have lived for a very, very long period of time.
This is a phenomenal species. It is something worth studying. It is something definitely worth knowing. And in my opinion, as a botanist, it is a miracle of this planet.
This is rainforest that predates the last ice age. Only 5% of this ancient coastal rainforest remains.
In the 1960s, this whole watershed was logged. In fact, 90% of the watershed was logged. And at that time, no protection was afforded to creeks and rivers and streams.
So they
actually logged right up to the creek banks and then through the wastewood into the stream. It was littered with logging debris, small branches to large cedar logs, and piled up. So debris jams that were blocking fish access upstream and were blocking water flow downstream. By opening it up, but retaining lots of the wood in the stream still, we're sort of restoring it back to a functioning habitat.
Now, can I make a comment about you? You're just a little woman. And how did you manage to get these huge logs around here back up to... What did you do?
It's really hard work, but we use sort of hand-powered mechanical winches and cables and pulley systems, and we sort of just pull the logs back, opening the stream up, and then sort of anchor them against the bank of the creek.
To my eyes, as a botanist, you've got the alders,
in excellent condition. Then you've got the lower shrubs that will feed the butterflies and the birds, and then going down into the gravel, you've got open the whole area, and you've got the stream running over gravel, which means the water is being oxygenated. And from your alders, then you have got lots and lots of really good lichens. And these are lichens on lichens producing ursolic acid, which sweeps the water clean in front of the salmon coming up here.
If they can do it with a very small baby in arms, if you can do it, I can do it. If she can do it, we can do it. And actually, we can all do it, because mm-hmm. there's lots of us around.
All over the world, we've taken down too much forest. In some instances, what's gone up are non-native trees into native spaces. Monoculture.
For example, here in Ireland, you'll see grape plantations. Well, let's call it plantations, because they're not really forests. It's of Sitka spruce. They're the green evergreens you see as you drive around the coastlands and right through the country. The problem is that Sitka spruce comes from the west coast of Canada and the United States.
They've been brought here for cheap and easy lumber. Like barley or corn, the tree plantation is a cash crop. It's not the heart and bones of a rich ecosystem that turns a group of trees into a forest. For that, we must look to the remains of the ancient native woodlands.
We don't have much native forest here at all in terms of hardwoods. We have a huge increase in commercial tree farming all over the world, of plantations of monocultures. Yeah. That are usually exotic trees that are not adapted to local conditions.
They're deserts.
They're not providing for biodiversity. Again, we need to emphasize why are the native trees and natural forests so important. It's because they're adapted to the place. Extremely customized. We forget that this planet was a rock a long time ago, and it was through plants and eventually trees that the soil humus was created and built up. And with the major loss of soil, with the clear felling of forests in uplands all over the world, causing major flooding problems, erosion, the loss of natural forest has led to major infertility. So it's important again that communities can protect themselves and their soil by creating their own local community, mixed native woodlands.
When I was a young girl in Ireland, there seemed to be no end to everything. And I remember being told that the hair on a person's head, you couldn't count their hairs, it was endless. And the same kind of thinking was applied to the freshwater lakes and the fish in the sea. There was no end to the fish and the trawling that could take place, and the forest could come down everywhere. There was such a richness on this planet that there was no end to it. The same goes for mining. Ores of all kind could be taken out of the earth, and there was no end to them. But today, it is not infinite. It is finite. There is an end to the forest. There is an end to the great ocean, the saline ocean, the fish in the sea. There is an end to mining. There is an end to all of these things. We have to manage our resources sustainably.
This is one forest in need of preservation, not restoration. It is the largest forest system in the world. It is holding its breath. And all we need do is preserve it.
The The boreal is the last great working forest in the world. It is about 30,000 years old. This forest system feeds the big and the small. Caribou, bears, deer, wolves and wolverines, beaver and snow leopards. Down to the minute mammals, just to name a few. It is the breadbasket for migration and nesting for many of the planet's songbirds and waterfowl. The boreal entombs a vast tonnage of cold carbon storage in the permafrost of the ground and waterways. In order to survive its 7-month harsh winter, with short days and reduced sunlight, the boreal has evolved over time into a complex web of cold hardy species, each dependent on all the others for its survival. That's why I call the boreal forest the mastermind of the world.
Lots of people are aware and know of the Amazon, but the planet holds this giant secret to the north.
The boreal sits upon the north of the globe like a crown, right across northern Canada and Scandinavia, and then across into Russia, where it is known as the taiga. It even touches northern Asia and Hokkaido, the most northern island of Japan, and into the Kuril Islands. The boreal accounts for 30% of the global forest.
In Canada, the backbone of that forest holds a pine tree called the jack pine, or the Pinus banksiana. They are lean and frugal, these trees. They're conifers, remember. They hang on to the needles for up to 7 years.
So it means their pull of nutrients out of the soil isn't very great. They can survive in very tough conditions.
There is a secondary forest of lichens, which covers the forest floor as a carpet and surfaces the trees. These lichens clean the atmosphere and pull nitrogen out of it.
And the forest lays down needles over vast periods of time, and those needles don't decompose, but they're a source of protein for the lichens, which take about 100 years to grow. Then there are the tripe lichens on rocks, and they take more than 100 years to grow. And then there are the bryonia lichens on all the trees, just lacing the trees. And they take an awfully long time to grow.
Its remote northern location has largely saved the boreal from the fate of the southern forests. But the age of megaprojects is rapidly changing that. In the boreal forest of northern Alberta, Canada, are the tar sands. A resource extraction project of immense proportions. With plans to expand over an area almost twice the size of Ireland.
This once living landscape is now dead. Giant hydroelectric projects are flooding on a similar scale. Then mining and logging. In all of the forests all over the world, there are trees that represent a biomass of about 300 billion tons of carbon dioxide, about a quarter to a third of it in and under the boreal. If the boreal forest comes down, we are looking at the release of an enormous tonnage of carbon dioxide into the air. Enough carbon dioxide into the air that it will make it toxic for us. You see, you can't replace or replant that boreal forest. You can never replace this complexity. Once it's gone, it's gone.
In the heart of North America, bordering the east shore of Lake Winnipeg, is Pamachuan Aki, similar in size to the country of Denmark. It holds a forest growing to its full potential. And it is by no accident this forest remains pristine. The Aboriginal people have fought to keep this land untouched. If the voices of its people are heard, it will become a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Sophia Rabliuskas from the Ojibwe Nation has spent her life in the Poplar River area in the heart of Manitoba's boreal forest.
For somebody to come in and say to you, well, we're going to cut all your trees, we're going to log this area, well, it's going to destroy your health first and destroy your families. It will be...
It's a threat, even a just threat. To say, you know, we're going to do that. This is our plan, and it's a threat. It was a threat to our way of life.
It must be very scary.
And it is, and that's why we took it upon ourselves that we're not going to allow this to happen. And we were very fortunate that we were able to find people who are out there to stand with us against these developments that continue to take and take and take. And that's the mentality that's out there. And I would, you know, get people saying to me, you will continue to keep your people in poverty because you're stopping development. You know, you're stopping community from benefiting from these projects. In the past, there were all these developments going on near Indigenous communities. And none of those Indigenous communities ever benefited from these projects or gained. Those people continue to live in poverty. Those people continue to have their resources extracted from their lands. So the idea came that maybe we should do a land use planning, mm-hmm. how the land is continued to be used to this day.
To help in the protection of their land, five Anishinaabe Ojibwe First Nation territories, provincial and federal governments, have all come together to propose Pamachuan Aki, the land that gives life, as a designated UNESCO World Heritage Site, to ensure mindful protection of both their culture and of these lands into the future.
They realized the land is most valuable to everyone, left as it is, with the trees growing in the earth.
We have been able to maintain that land for thousands of years, the way it is, yeah. untouched by development, mm-hmm. pristine boreal forest, healthy ecosystem. When I was walking through the bush with my father, and when he said, you know, don't forget to stop and look around you yeah. and feel the earth around you, the beauty. So each generation has its responsibility.
What do you say?
Be grounded. Don't lose that. That's the wisdom of that land. It reminds you of who you are. Once you connect to that land, you will do anything to fight for it.
Here we've got how many thousands and thousands of tons of material in this oak wood. Mm-hmm. Where has it come from? Mm-hmm. It hasn't quarried from it. Mm-hmm. It hasn't taken from anything.
It's taken from the air.
Yep. It's taken from the water and the sun. And it's created this wealth. The earth needs over one-third cover, forest cover, and more to have a balance. And to ensure fertility of soil.
And oxygenation of the air.
Yeah. So we can't wait for organisations, we can't wait for politicians. No. It's not rocket science to put the forest back. Communities could be trained to engage in the restoration, in collecting the seed, creating the nurseries. There's plenty of work to be done restoring the forest.
Yeah. Once you connect with that land, you will do anything to fight for it.